Hello, I'm Puelo Deer. This is number 0498, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now. Like, right now. No, I mean right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0498. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back to talk about mental health and the healing properties of humor.
It's amazing how just a few minutes of laughter can lower your heart rate, increase your respiratory system, can lower stress levels. In fact, there's specific hormones, one of them is called clotho, that's released, and it actually increases the elasticity of your veins and arteries and lowers your risk of having strokes because it gives the veins and arteries room to expand and not have to rupture due to blockage and stuff like that.
Lorraine Justice, author of The Future of Design, Global Product Innovation in a Complex World, discusses robots in the workforce.
The realism that's coming along with some of the robots is extraordinary. And it is a little bit creepy because they have facial expressions like we do, and it will just get better and better. But, you know, the other kind of robots, they're not humanoid robots. They're just in every area now. And, you know, I titled that comment, "The Robots Are Coming," but actually, they're already here.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman. Did you hear the one about the Book Banter segment where I review the book about stand-up comedy in the 70s called I'm Dying Up Here? Well, if you want to see if I will kill it, like Carlin or Pryor, get yourself a table for the show that's coming up very soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0498, was Puelo Deer, a PR specialist who has worked on many projects. There are several Montreal-shot movies coming out in 2019 that he's publicizing, including Long Shot, starring Charlize Theron, Pet Sematary, starring Jason Clarke and John Lithgow, Midway, directed by Roland Emmerich, and he's currently working on Dreamland, starring Gary Oldman, Armie Hammer, and Evangeline Lilly. In other words, Puelo is extremely busy, so I'm glad he took a few minutes out of his busy schedule to do the guest slate. Thank you very much, Puelo. Much appreciated. And, of course, the Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, here's a philosophical question to ponder as I share this first story with you. And that question is, how far would you go to follow your principles? Well, according to Stephen Martin, his Colorado Springs Primetime Sports Store is the only fully licensed, full-service National Football League fan shop between Castle Rock, Colorado, and the New Mexico border. Martin also has strong feelings about former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick's decision to kneel in protest during the national anthem. When Denver Broncos linebacker Brandon Marshall followed suit, Martin canceled an autograph session with Marshall in his store, and when Nike ran ads featuring Kaepernick last fall, Marshall removed all Nike merchandise from his store in protest. Now, declining sales have forced Martin to shut down the store after 20 years. As much as I hate to admit this, Martin said, perhaps there are more Brandon Marshall and Colin Kaepernick supporters out there than I realized. You figure? Yeah. Yep, he stopped selling Nike, and then his sales went swoosh. Gee, a 20-year business down the drain. What's he going to do next? Sell gay wedding cakes? Patrolling officers in Cape Coral, Florida, saw a car spin out and then speed away and pull the driver over. The argumentative driver insisted that officers should just give him a warning. When officers insisted, he reluctantly handed over his driver's license and then sped off, leaving his license behind. Officers simply went to the home of 30-year-old Vincent Parlato and arrested him on charges of fleeing and eluding law enforcement and resisting without violence. They did, however, wait a week to do it. You know, sometimes letting them sweat for a while is the best punishment. Okay, those of you out there who are younger baby boomers, do you remember perhaps playing a little Barry White on the car radio and making out in the backseat?
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby.
Yeah, those were the days. Bet you never did it in a police car, though.
I don't know about that. There's many times that we've loved and we've shared love and made love. Doesn't seem to me like it's enough.
A Florida police officer was suspended for allegedly allowing an arrested couple to smoke a cigarette and perform sex acts in the backseat of his patrol car while the officer played Barry White's notoriously sexy tune, Can't Get Enough of Your Love, Babe.
My darling, I can't get enough of your love, babe.
The Fort Pierce Police Department said it suspended Officer Doug McNeil for 20 days without pay, stating he violated several policies during the July 14th arrest that was captured on the police car's dash cam. McNeil arrested the couple on shoplifting charges following an incident inside a Walmart last summer. Authorities said 23-year-old Zachary Molendick and 24-year-old Krista Lee were placed in the backseat of the patrol car. The man wasn't in handcuffs and the pair were not wearing seatbelts. Video shows Molendick having a cigarette before getting in the cruiser unrestrained. The couple is then seen cuddling, kissing, and performing sex acts on each other while Barry White played on the car's radio.
I feel a change, something moved. I scream your name, look what you got to do it, darling. I can't get enough of your love, baby.
The officer then allowed the arrested couple to smoke in the back seat while he completed paperwork. So that smoking after sex thing isn't just a cliche. McNeil told an internal affairs detective that he saw the couple kissing and was fine with it, but denied seeing any sexual activity. The officer violated several policies, including authorized restraint, detainee transport operations, special transport situations, and use of tobacco products. McNeil was suspended from duty on February 14th. Ironically, a day known for celebrating love and Barry White.
It's the same old feeling every time you're here. I feel a change, something moved. I scream your name, look what you got to do with all I got. Can't get enough of your love, baby.
Yeah, baby. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? As the saying goes, laughter is the best medicine. But does laughter really make you better, especially when it comes to mental health? Well, we put that question to clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. And John joins us on the line once again from Texas. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter Anthony Holder. How are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo, sir. Just tickety-boo.
Awesome.
So what are the benefits of laughter? I mean, is that a real thing?
Oh, definitely a real thing. It's amazing how just a few minutes of laughter can lower your heart rate, increase your respiratory system, can lower stress levels. In fact, there's specific hormones, one of them is called clotho, that's released, and it actually increases the elasticity of your veins and arteries and lowers your risk of having strokes because it gives the veins and arteries room to expand and not have to rupture due to blockage and stuff like that. It also, again, lowers your blood pressure and reduces your risk of cardiovascular problems in general. So that's one side. The other side is it actually increases blood flow. You get a good abdominal workout when you're going through that process. And it is just an amazing thing. And even when you fake it, we find out, if you fake laughing, we find out that those individuals get the same benefits as if they really were laughing.
Now, everybody knows at least one really old crotchety person with no sense of humor. How do you explain their existence?
Well, you know, just like it's hard to kill a cockroach, I think. You know, some people are just hard to kill off, and they're resilient. I mean, we are biological animals that have survived for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It doesn't mean they were all happy, but we do know that it does help you, and it can increase longevity if you do have a good laugh every day. So my motto around here is there's always something that during the day we can find to laugh at least one time during the day.
Well, you may have answered my next question, when that is basically, as someone who is a mental health professional, when dealing with someone with mental health issues, which can sometimes be depression, which in itself is not a happy thing for anyone to go through, how do you get someone to understand the benefits of laughter when they're in a depressive state to start with?
Well, you know, when you're in a depressive state, it's hard to feel anything else altogether. So one of the things that I try to do if I'm incorporating that is I incorporate humor in my therapy in general. That's who I am. I mean, I like to find things to smile and laugh about all the time. And based on my reaction of my clients, I start to try and teach them to look at life a little bit different and reframe things in that humorous kind of way. Because as bad as things are, believe it or not, it's almost always possible to be worse. And it may not feel like that, but if you step outside of yourself sometimes, it's amazing how my clients can find things that would be even worse than what they're going through right then. So with that in mind, I try to pay a lot of attention to body language with my clients. And if I can get them to just crack a smile during a session, I feel like I've made headway. Of course, I'm using regular cognitive behavioral interventions and stuff like that along the way. And then I do some training. I talk to them about, you know, you go in with your kids and you don't want to sit there and make breakfast for your kids while you're depressed and be crying and they all get upset. So what do? And, you know, they talk about suppressing their feelings. I go, well, why not kind of turn that around and start laughing at things? You know, even sarcastic laughing has benefits in that situation. So I start changing their perspective, get them to start changing their behavior. And it's amazing how behavior starts changing your mood, and mood can change your behavior. It's a two-way street. So if I get them to start practicing laughing at things that they really don't think are funny, but they think other people think they're funny, that is the pathway right there. And all of a sudden they start actually finding things to be funny at and laugh at, and they start to enjoy that.
Well, that
we also then move it down to one more thing, and that is, okay, you've only got 40 minutes to be upset and depressed and cry today, but you got to do it at 11 o'clock at night after your kids are gone to bed.
We're now living in a world that is unfortunately very politically correct. So what you just said a few moments ago about finding things to laugh at, even if there are things that are not funny, but maybe funny to you, that can bring about a whole other world of trouble for you.
Well, theoretically, it could. But the whole idea is I'm trying to teach this person to become resilient. And if they know what their own angst are and their own boundaries are, it doesn't really matter what other people think. They're so into themselves because of their depression that they just want to get through the day, and they could really care less of what other people are thinking at that point. And they would rather have a laughter fit than to turn around and tell somebody, you know, a bunch of expletives and tell them to go find themselves, you know, and with some objectionable behaviors and stuff like that later. So
when it comes to the spectrum of depression, you have the highs and the lows. So you might have someone who gets very, very dour one day, and is elated and happy and laughing the next day, which is part of their depression. So how do you define the difference between healthy laughter and unhealthy laughter in this case?
Well, what you're describing to me is what is also called bipolar disorder. It's what we call manic depressives. I don't want my patients being manic when they laugh. I want them to find the happiness and joy in that moment. If they're manic, that is a whole nother diagnosis, and it's a whole nother direction that we have to deal with. And those individuals are so much more susceptible to the possibility of things like suicide that there's a whole nother direction that I typically go in that situation. So if they're coming back and they're telling me that already, I'm not going to treat them the same way as I do someone who's just depressed as a mood disorder.
Now, you listed off some of the health benefits, not just mental health, but physical benefits of laughter earlier. One of the things is boosting brain power. How exactly does that work?
It increases blood flow. And blood flow oxygenates the brain and brings food, nutrition, to the brain itself. And your brain will function better when it's fully oxygenated and fully fed. On top of that, you know, what happens is also that laughter causes your endocrine system and all the lymph nodes to flush out the waste products, not just out of there, but out of your brain, too. We know the lymph system goes up into the brain. So it's very beneficial. Laughter is a great thing. If somebody has a problem with laughter, they've got something internally wrong with them. Step aside, move on down the road. Don't let them keep you from finding that laughter humorous.
So you do believe in the old adage then that laughter is the best medicine?
Absolutely.
You are aware of the fact that I am in Canada, where we have socialized medicine, and our dollar is not as valuable as yours. So all the way around, laughter here is cheap.
Oh, you set me up for that one. Okay.
I'm just saying.
I love it, though. Well, yeah, you know, I hadn't looked at it from that perspective, but that's what it looks like. Yeah. In fact, one of the things I do every year is I do a comedy show here in Austin, Texas, as a fundraiser for my nonprofit. And last year I was lucky enough to get up to New York City and go to Comic Strip Live. I'll be back there in June. So I think humor is very important for our species, period. And yeah, the beauty about humor is that it's not often politically correct. In fact, a lot of time it's not. And if we can't laugh at the things that are wrong with us, then we got a problem right there.
Well said, and we'll leave it on that. Thank you very much, John, for being on the program with us once again. Always a joy to have you on the show.
You are amazing, Peter. Thank you so much, and keep moving forward.
Dr. John Huber, Chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0498, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about robots in the workforce, plus Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. We have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, plus, of course, much more in the Stuff File news department here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? A woman in St. Louis, Missouri, called police at 10:15 p.m. to say she saw a man looking in her window. Sure enough, when officers arrived, they found a man hiding in the bushes outside her home. He ran when he saw the police, but he was captured and identified as 36-year-old Michael McCusker, a co-worker of the victim who has a history of inappropriate and offensive communication towards said victim, who has lodged complaints with her employer. The employer? St. Louis Priory School, a Catholic school for grades 7 to 12 boys. Father McCusker is a priest and theology teacher there, and a Benedictine monk at the abbey next door. Or at least he was. The school announced he has been removed from his position there and kicked out of his campus housing. McCusker is charged with stalking and resisting arrest. Give me a second here. Let me thumb through the vows of Benedictine monks. Let's see here. Let me find what I'm looking for here. Turn the page. No, that's not it. Oh, here we go. Rule of St. Benedict 58, 17 to 18a. When he is to be received, he comes before the whole community in the oratory and promises stability, fidelity to monastic life, and obedience. This is done in the presence of God and his saints. Let's just close that book. Ooh, clearly McCusker skipped an important passage or two.
If you want my body, and you think I'm sexy, come on, sugar, let me know. If you really need me, just reach out and touch me. Come on, honey, tell me so.
A 55-year-old Manchester, England woman named Joan has a unique project in mind for a custom clothing designer. It seems Joan is anticipating having her leg amputated because of peripheral arterial disease, so she posted on Sewport.com, which is a sourcing website for clothes manufacturers, requesting help to create something beautiful and useful, a handbag using her own skin. She has budgeted about $3,900 for the project, which she envisions as a medium-sized handbag with a short strap and a section down the middle that will be made from my skin, she explained in the post. I know it's a bit odd and gross, but it's my leg, and I can't bear the thought of it being left to rot somewhere. There are no laws against her keeping the leg, although there is paperwork to fill out. Boris Hodekel, the founder of Sewport.com, reports that no designers have come forward yet to help with Joan's request. Well, this is a little Silence of the Lambs-like, isn't it? I'd like to think that the odds of someone agreeing to do this are pretty slim, but then again, fashion designers and manufacturers are a daring lot. Still, I think Joan is going out on a limb with this one. A Tennessee man was jailed on felony charges after appearing to dip his testicles into a container of salsa that a customer had ordered online. The delivery driver allegedly recorded it and posted a video online saying, "This is what you get when you give an 89-cent tip for an almost 30-minute drive." News outlets report that the passenger, 31-year-old Howard Matthew Webb, was arrested last week and charged with adulteration of food. Okay, let's stop right there for a second. The charge is adulteration of food. Now, believe it or not, that charge isn't exactly what it sounds like, but in this case, it's exactly what it sounds like. For the record, the definition of adulteration of food refers to the foreign or usually inferior chemical substance present in food that causes harm or is unwanted in the food. There, the more you know. Yes. Dinner Delivered said the food service has fired the driver and forwarded information about her to authorities as well. Webb remains behind bars pending a March 12th hearing. His arrest warrant says they picked up the food for delivery from a local Mexican restaurant. The company issued a refund for the tainted food. Okay, As any guy will tell you, the area around Crosby, Stills, and Nash contains rather sensitive skin. The idea of dipping the trio into a container of salsa has definitely got to be wrought with peril. And finally, in this section of Stuffall News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuffall program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and while we're still down there, so to speak, an Indiana man accidentally shot himself in his genitalia, according to the Marion Police Department in Indiana. Deputy Chief Stephen Dorsey said officers came in contact with the 46-year-old man in the emergency room of Marion General Hospital shortly before 7 a.m. There, the man told officers he was on a walkway near a Girl Scout cabin when the high-point 9mm handgun on his waist began to slip. The man said he reached down to adjust the gun, accidentally causing it to discharge. Police said the bullet entered just above the man's penis and exited his scrotum. According to police, the man doesn't have an Indiana handgun license, and the case will be sent to the Grant County Prosecutor's Office for review. You know, I'm a bit dismayed at this story because it doesn't give complete details to the outcome. It really doesn't mention if there is any permanent damage to Jim and the twins. In a nutshell, this story is basically half-cocked. Anyway, let's go to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuffall program, shall we? In the near future, robots will be able to perform jobs ranging from bartending to retail sales and even major surgery. Design expert Lorraine Justice says she knows a lot of people who make robots. She says they're so realistic, they're creepy. So, as a society, how do we prepare for what will be a changing job market? Lorraine is Dean Emeritus of the College of Imaging Arts and Sciences at Rochester Institute of Technology, former director of the School of Design at Hong Kong Polytechnic University, and the author of The Future of Design, Global Product Innovation in a Complex World. She joins us on the line from Rochester, New York. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi, Peter. Great. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So, as someone who's involved in design, I guess you have a vested interest in what robots do and how they look. So, what are your feelings about robots besides the fact that they're realistic yet maybe creepy?
Well, I have to say the realism that's coming along with some of the robots is extraordinary. And it is a little bit creepy because they have facial expressions like we do. And, you know, soon it will just get better and better. And but, you know, the other kind of robots, they're not humanoid robots. They're just in every area now. And, you know, I titled that comment, "The Robots Are Coming," but actually they're already here.
Would people be surprised at how much of a presence they already have in our society?
Well, yes. In fact, as a designer, I started to think about which robots were in my life right now. And I had an operation last year that was robot-assisted. The doctor said she really needed to use the robot to do a good job. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then when I look at how things have been delivered to the house and where what's happening in warehousing and food, making food get to the house, all of that distribution and technology is a lot of it's robot-driven.
Now, the biggest fear a lot of people have looking down the road is the idea that we have so many robots and they become more and more intelligent, especially with AI, with artificial intelligence, that at some point they'll just take over and get rid of us. Do you feel concerned about this or not?
Well, right now, no. I think we need to look at what robots and technology can do for us, but we also need to keep a restraint on what they're used for. You know, there's always the world annihilation scenario that's very scary with robots and technical warfare. But for the most part, technology and robots in particular can really assist our lives. I mean, more than just, you know, vacuuming our floor or, you know, potentially folding our clothes. There's so much that we can use robotics for.
You mentioned a concern about giving too many duties or ideas to what robots can do. What do you think, and again, someone who has actually benefited from having surgery that was partially done by robotics, what are your concerns about things that robots should not be doing?
Well, for me, the scary part is if robots are involved in warfare or, you know, and then there are the software robots, which I, you know, where it's hacking and really decimating some of the software and functionality out there on our systems, internet systems. So it's how the robots are going to be used and who is designing them and for what use. And we won't always get those answers because a lot of that is probably done in secrecy. People either won't share, you know, what they're doing, or they can't share. So we all really need to be, I don't want to sound alarmist, but we really need to, I want to say, monitor a bit what's going on.
Well, as someone who was in the world of design, and your book is The Future of Design, Global Product Innovation in a Complex World, what would you like to see going ahead in the future with robotics that is part of its design?
Well, thanks for asking that, Peter. What I would love to see are more designers on more teams that are building robots of all kinds, because designers can help with safety issues and ethical issues and just the general experience around robots. And I was thinking about, you know, the Japanese culture loves robots, and they're more welcoming to that type of technology. But in the United States, a lot of it just wouldn't fly. Or people may be charmed at first, but then they really don't want to talk to a machine. And this is where designers can really come in and suggest other ways to do things.
I noticed when you talked about designers that you said it in the plural, as in designing teams. Is part of your concern the fact that sometimes as people, we don't necessarily see the forest for the trees? We plow ahead with great ideas of what we shouldn't be doing, but sometimes we forget what the effects of what we might be doing are, and that is minimized by having more heads in the room, so to speak, more brains in the room coming up with ideas, because someone can give the negatives to somebody else's positives.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not just with technology. It's with, when we look at how the cultures are shifting and rapidly, and governments are changing, and people's experiences are changing, you know, what they want, consumer demands. I mean, for anyone doing a product or software or service, they really, really need to get more heads in on their designing. And it pays off in, you know, being risk averse and really understanding what you're getting into as far as problems, especially in other countries.
When we think of robotics and robots, we often think of some of the high-end situations that you mentioned, such as in medical technology and in operations. But what about the robots that are already here to a great extent? The robots that will do the mundane and replace people, for instance, say, in factory jobs and the like. Are you concerned not only with what the robots are doing, but how it's replacing a human workforce? And what will that human workforce do in the future?
Well, what's interesting is I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I saw the demise of the steel mills. And what didn't happen initially was that the people were not retrained for other jobs. They had to scramble to find new jobs and training and new degrees and all that. Well, we're smarter now. We know that if we're going to replace a lot of humans, we really need to either re-educate those humans or find other viable things that they can do. Now, the other side of that argument is, oh, if they get done with the mundane stuff, they'll get to work more on the higher creativity end of things. But, you know, that's for some people. It's not, you know, the average factory worker really probably needs a program alongside what they're doing for change. You know, what are they interested in? What can they segue into? That kind of thing.
Now, as someone who spent 7 years working as a television news anchor, it's interesting that China's state-run Xinhua News Agency has launched an artificial intelligence TV news anchor, which is a world's first. That's scary to me. But besides that point, you mentioned Japan earlier. I mentioned in your introduction that you were the former director of the School of Design at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University. Generally speaking, is Asia ahead of us when it comes to technologies using robots than we are here in the West, in North America, and in Europe?
I would say yes. I think there was an easier adoption early on. I think that they did a lot of leapfrogging where, you know, they didn't start out at the base level of thinking about or understanding or building. But in some cases, they forged ahead and was, you know, on their own and really looked at what technology and robots could do. So in some cases, yes, they're ahead of us. And I think that the thing that worries me is when if a country becomes very closed to what they're doing and we don't understand the technology we're using, that can cause a lot of, you know, paranoia. So I'm hoping that people will share more about what they're doing.
One last question before I let you go, and that is, again, your book is The Future of Design, Global Product Innovation in a Complex World. Who did you write your book for? Who is your audience?
I wrote this for anyone who is thinking about doing a global product or service or designing an experience, because it's become so complex these days and robots are only part of the problem or opportunity.
And is it a fine line, as you just described, from being problem or opportunity?
It can be, and it could mean, you know, depending on the situation, it could mean whether it makes life more enjoyable or not.
Lorraine, I thank you very much for being on the program with us. It was a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you.
Thank you, Peter.
Lorraine Justice, author of The Future of Design, Global Product Innovation in a Complex World. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this program, which is show number 0498. And you'll find links to Lorraine's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Derigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. It's no surprise to hear that law professors do a lot of things other than teach law. They serve as expert witnesses, provide free legal advice, and often write scholarly articles. But they also file lawsuits, too. Lots of them. Until recently, however, no one knew what kind of record law professors have when they set out to practice what they preach, so to speak. Until now. A new study by, who else, a law professor, finds that the lawsuits filed by members of his profession are striking for how often they focus on three things: dissatisfaction with and professional jealousy of their colleagues, disagreements with and distrust of administrators, and a feeling that others are receiving better and undeserved treatment. Let's be fair, you're probably wondering how they fare in all those lawsuits, right? Well, the study found that law professors generally do a poor job of assessing their chances, for they lose much more often than they win. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine.
The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And safely back from the Mile High City, we do indeed have Stuart Nauman. Hello, Stu.
Hello, Peter. And I survived the thin air up in Denver, Colorado.
Welcome back to lower terra firma.
Yeah. Oh, but a nice city, very laid back. And I was there for BBYO's annual international convention, where it was myself, about well over 200 staff, and about close to 4,000 teens from around the world.
And for those who don't know, that would be the B'nai B'rith Youth Organization?
You got it, Peter. That's okay. Correct. So this year, our annual convention was in Denver. First time I was there. Beautiful city. You know, you see the vista of the Rocky Mountains surrounding Denver. But another reason why I had a few minutes, I had a free lunchtime before the teens all arrived. I went to, being a book lover, I went to, made a pilgrimage, so to speak, to a place called the Tattered Cover, which is regarded as one of the best independent bookstores in America. And there's four locations in Denver. There's one in Aspen as well. I went to the one in the historic, they call it Lower Downtown, or they call the Lodo District of Denver. It's in this old building that was built about a century ago. And the four locations, the five locations, have over 500,000 books in stock. And I love this place because not only is the selection great, but the atmosphere is so relaxed. It's like a log cabin. You go there and, you know, you sit in one of those chairs and you're going to sink right in, and you just want to spend hours browsing through the great selection of books they got in the magazines. And there's coffee. There's a coffee place, too, in there. It's really, if you're a book lover and you're going to happen to be in the Rockies, you happen to be in the Mile High City, go visit the Tattered Cover. You know, make that pilgrimage. It's so worth it. I even bought a book from there, too. So.
When have you gone into a bookstore and not bought a book? They see you coming. Every bookstore sees you coming. So it's the Tattered Cover, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And do they have a website?
Yes, they do. You just go to www.tatteredcover.com and you'll find out, you know, what they got and the multitude of events that they have, and special events and contests and what have you. It's a real great community bookstore. And I, you know, next time I'm there, that'll be one of my first visits again.
I will make sure that there's a link to the Tattered Cover on our website at thestufffile.com. In the meantime, besides what you may have purchased from the Tattered Cover, what are you talking about tonight?
Well, speaking of gems, I mean, Tattered Cover is a gem. On this edition of Book Banter, I decided to do one of those change of pace kind of shows where a book that I've discovered, which, you know, was published a while ago and is, to me, a gem and should be, you know, discovered by you, the listeners. And it's one book that was published about 10 years ago. It's called I'm Dying Up Here. And it's about stand-up comedy because, you know, the stand-up comic, as we know today, has been around for about well over 50 years. And these days, comics have plenty of means to practice and, you know, develop their craft. You know, there's clubs across the continent. There's cable TV. There's festivals, albums, satellite radio, talk shows, streaming. You name it. The end result is to be a mega success like Jerry Seinfeld, Dave Chappelle, Kevin Hart, or even Jay Leno, to name a few. But the early 70s, comics didn't have so many forums to develop that craft. There was, you know, the pinnacle of success was getting a spot on the Johnny Carson show. Or basically, you know, there's the odd nightclub or two. Or, you know, get another enviable gig was being an opening act for a very popular music star's tour, whether it be across United States, across Canada, or you know, or around the world. And it was just as difficult, if not more so, for a comic to get that big break. So if you wanted to get that head start, you had to make the trek west to its two main proving grounds, which were the Improv and the Comedy Store, where people like Robin Williams, Jay Leno, Andy Kaufman, David Letterman paid their comedy dues. I mean, the hours were tough. The pay was very little, if any pay at all, and the struggles to survive, and the comics, those aspiring comics, struggled to survive with a capital S. And if you succeeded, you succeeded big. If you failed, you failed hard. So that battle to struggle, survive and succeed as a stand-up comic during its golden age of the 1970s is chronicled in this very heartbreaking, in-depth book called I'm Dying Up Here. And this book inspired the Showtime series a couple of summers ago that was in which Jim Carrey served as executive producer. And it spotlights that group of struggling young comics, both familiar and unfamiliar, like Richard Lewis, Tom Dreesen, there's George Miller, Lane Boozler, as they desperately climb their way to the top of the comedy world and all the obstacles that was thrown in front of them. And many perform sets at the Improv and the Comedy Store at all hours of the day and night. Basically they would, and afterwards they would gather at Cantor's Deli to basically share their war stories. Now, if there's one main villain in this book, it's the late Mitzi Shar, who was the queen of the Comedy Store.
I was going to say that name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The mother of Polly.
Yes. That alone is a criminal offense, but I stopped. Oh,
but. Yeah, but her notoriety wasn't because of being the mother of Polly. She ruled that club and the comics who performed there, with an iron fist. If it was, she had their own reign of terror. Somehow she had the power to decide which comics would perform and where, and whether it be on the original comics, Comedy Store on the Sunset Strip, in Westwood, or in La Jolla, California. And she steadfastly maintained that because the Comedy Store was more like a quote-unquote college, where comics got the opportunity for on-the-job training, so to speak, to be a professional stand-up, and on the road to success, she never paid these comics a red cent for their work. And this resulted in a very bitter comedian strike in 1979, in which the Comedy Store was picketed by its stable of comedians, and would create bitter divisions between not only Mitzi Shar and the comics who performed there, but other comics who either respected or did not respect the picket line during that strike. Now, on the other side of the coin, if there was a tragic figure in this book, it was the late Steve Lubetkin. This native of New York City who grew up watching comedians and knew at an early age that the life of a professional comedian was for him, he fought and struggled so hard to realize that dream. And despite his father's reluctant support, and after a number of failures, like he made an independent movie that funded out of his own pocket, but that was a failure, tried to do a comedy team with his girlfriend, that didn't work out, had chances of appearing on TV with some interview by his friend Richard Lewis, but was cut out in the last minute. And after losing a lucrative big gig at the La Jolla Comedy Store by Mitzi during the strike, Lubetkin committed suicide by jumping off the roof of a hotel that was located near the Sunset Strip Comedy Store. Now, this book is very deep and insightful, and tells the human story of the heroes and villains of the early days of stand-up comedy. And somehow after you finish reading this hard-hitting book, you realize that stand-up comics still have to go through a difficult, spirit-breaking process to be as successful in the comedy world as their brethren went through about 45, 50 years ago.
So what you're saying, it's a book about comedy that won't make you laugh?
It will at some points, but it's more of the, like they have the comedy and tragedy masks?
Yes.
Well, there is the comedy mask, but there's a lot of that tragedy part too.
Mm. Pagliacci's Revenge.
Oh yeah, but it's quite a book actually, and this Showtime series is all of, a fictionalized version of the book. It's still quite hard hitting.
And the book is
called "I'm Dying Up Here" by William. And please excuse the pronunciation. It's Nodel Setter. Okay. It's published by Public Affairs Book, and it's available in paperback for the Canadian price. And this is how it's listed, Peter: $22.49.
Okay. And if you were looking for something else in a similar genre, what would that be, sir?
Well, I figured, this book and the two books I'm going to cite in a second should be read together as a trilogy about the history of stand-up comedy. The first one is they're two very seminal works. The first one's called The Last Laugh by Phil Burke, and that was published back in 1975. It was one of the first books to seriously look at the world of the stand-up comic.
And very quickly, the other two, because we're running out of time?
Well, besides I'm Dying Up Here, and you start with that one, then you got I'm Dying Up Here, and then Comedy on the Edge by Richard Zoglin, which is a history of the stand-up comedy of the 70s and how it influenced comedy today. Excellent books.
Excellent. And how can people find you, sir?
Well, if I'm not going to be going back to the tattered cover, well, I probably eventually, you'll find me in the pages of the Montreal Times every Saturday in print or digitally at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you. And, of course, there is an Idiot of the Day coming your way. But since we were just talking about books with Stuart, I thought I'd take a brief moment to, you know, plug my book. Yes, my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing, whom we just lost a few months ago, and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and more, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. So check it out. It's available at Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as on my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com, and you'll find links to find the book on our website at TheStuffWild.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? Anyway, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Authorities say a Florida man accused of threatening his family ended a four-hour standoff with police after he was promised a slice of pizza. 33-year-old Evan Charles McLemore was arrested and charged with resisting an officer and aggravated stalking. Police say officers responded to a report of a possible battery at the Pensacola home and found McLemore had barricaded himself in a room. Officers said McLemore claimed to have a gun, so they brought in a SWAT team. Crisis negotiators eventually managed to coax McLemore out with the promise of pizza. It wasn't clear if he actually received a slice. Okay, so the charges are resisting an officer and aggravated stalking. I understand the stalking charge, but is it really resisting an officer when you agree to come out for a slice of pizza? Oh, sure, it was 4 hours after the incident started, but still, isn't that just really a protracted negotiation? Yeah. A professional stuntman attempted to break a Guinness record by performing jumping jacks while on fire at a Michigan festival celebrating Nicolas Cage. Shuler White, who served as the actor's stunt double in the 2016 film Dog Eat Dog, was ignited at the kickoff event for the 6th annual Nicolas Uncaged event, which is held in a suburb of Detroit. White shared photos from the attempt on Facebook. An on-site official counted White's jumping jacks before being extinguished at 12, short of his goal of over 30. The Guinness World Record for most consecutive jumping jacks, full body burn, was set by Sean Kinney when he performed 30 jumping jacks in 2015 in Los Angeles. And I know, I don't know why either. The Nicolas Uncaged Festival, an unofficial celebration of the actor's work, features film screenings as well as performances of songs, skits, and poetry inspired by Cage. Oh, dear Lord. These are some people who definitely have a lot of time on their hands. Okay, full disclosure. Raising Arizona aside, which I do have on DVD, I am definitely not the biggest Nicolas Cage fan. Not even close. So this festival is something I really don't understand. And as for that 2016 film Dog Eat Dog, if you don't remember it, you're really not alone. It chalked up an extremely unimpressive $70,000 at the box office. I'm sure if you search hard enough, you can find it on video. Back in my day, a film like that would just be turned into guitar picks. Yeah. Anyway, John Brissett got a notification that an Amazon package had been delivered to his home in Parkland, Florida, and his wife went right out to the porch to get it. But it wasn't there. Julie Brissett pulled up video from her Ring doorbell cam to see what happened. She saw the delivery driver put the package on the mat, take a photo to prove delivery, and picked the package up and walked away with it. Said Julie, "I had to watch it twice, to be honest with you, because it was so shocking." She called the sheriff to report the theft. The driver will be easy to track down. The Brissettes live in a gated community, and visitors have to show ID to get in. Well, that guy is a moron. Wouldn't it be ironic if on a previous delivery it was the same driver who delivered the Ring doorbell cam in the first place? Yeah. I put that guy close to being an idiot. I mean, he's a moron, one step down. So he's kind of idiot adjacent. Which means, if he's idiot adjacent, it's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the idiot of the day.
An Alabama man is jailed on charges of trying to blow up his own mother using a propane tank in a booby-trapped storage shed. Chief Deputy Rocky Harnin of the Jackson County Sheriff's Office said a woman called police saying she was worried her son was both on drugs and storing propane in a shed. Harnin says an officer went to the home and a small explosion occurred when the officer and the man's mother entered the building. Harnin says a small device was supposed to explode and ignite the propane, but the gas wasn't turned on. No one was hurt. 45-year-old Roger Dale Johnson of Woodville is charged with attempted assault and possession of a destructive device. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you think you could blow up your own mother by booby-trapping a shed with propane in it without turning the propane on? Well, two reasons, actually. One, you didn't bother paying attention in any high school science classes. And two, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0498. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0498. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.